It's 7 o'clock on Saturday, the 13th of September. Good morning. This is Today with John Humphreys and Martha Carney.
The news headlines this morning at the World Trade Organization talks in Mexico. They've been negotiating late into the night, but there's still no agreement that would help the world's poorest. The American Secretary of State Colin Powell has dismissed a call from France to transfer power in Iraq to the Iraqi people soon. Later in the programme, the debate in one Swedish family on whether to join the euro. And scientific proof that garlic doesn't only kill vampires. Today's newsreader is Peter Donaldson.
Bitter squabbling over the key issue of farm subsidies has continued to divide the world trade talks in Mexico. With just 48 hours left for an agreement, the World Trade Organization has said the talks in the resort of Cancun are on a knife edge because of what it calls the posturing between rich and poor nations. The developing countries are demanding big cuts in the subsidies given by the United States and European Union countries to their farmers. They, in turn, want greater access to global markets. As pressure mounts for both sides to give ground, the Mexican security forces are preparing to deal with a major demonstration near the venue of the talks. From Cancun, our World Affairs correspondent, Mike Wooldridge.
Only 2 days of the conference remain, and the detailed negotiations around a draft declaration have yet to begin. For the past 3 days, mediators have been working with delegations to weigh up the chances of narrowing the divisions over farm subsidies and access to markets in particular. This has taken place as a significant new grouping of developing countries has emerged within the WTO, targeting the subsidies paid by the US and European governments to their farmers. The EU has put forward a proposal to meet concerns expressed here by West African countries, who say these subsidies harm their own cotton producers. Oxfam's called it the first significant step to deliver on the promises of this round of trade negotiations, intended to benefit the developing world. But there isn't an abundance of optimism here that a weekend of tough bargaining can produce the consensus needed for a global trade deal to be concluded in 15 months' time. And one developing country trade minister has warned that if the opportunity is lost now, it could be lost for years.
The American Secretary of State, Colin Powell, has rejected a proposal from France for the United States to transfer power in Iraq to a provisional government as early as next month. Mr. Powell was speaking as he travelled to Geneva for a meeting today of foreign ministers from the five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council to discuss the rebuilding of Iraq. Here's our Washington correspondent, Rob Watson.
The war in Iraq may be over, but the US and France, it seems, have still not made peace with each other. Speaking before the Geneva meeting, US Secretary of State Colin Powell dismissed as totally unrealistic proposals from his French counterpart and critic, Dominique de Villepin. On Friday, the French foreign minister had suggested the establishment of a provisional Iraqi government in a month, a draft constitution by the end of the year, and elections by next spring. On his way to Geneva, Colin Powell said it would be delightful if one could do that, but that it wasn't possible. What the US wants instead is more cooperation between the Iraqi Governing Council and the UN, and the creation of a multinational force under an American commander. The Americans are anxious for international help in Iraq, but not at any price.
The UN has joined in the condemnation of Israel for its threat to expel the Palestinian president Yasser Arafat from the West Bank. At the end of a meeting to discuss the latest developments in the Middle East, the Security Council said such a move would be unhelpful. It urged both Israel and the Palestinians to show restraint. From New York, our UN correspondent Greg Barrow.
This meeting took place amidst growing concern about the decision in principle by the Israeli government to expel the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. The UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has described the decision as dangerous and counterproductive. The Security Council said the move was unhelpful and advised Israel that it should not be implemented. The Palestinian Observer Mission to the United Nations has been circulating a draft UN resolution demanding that Israel desist from any act of deportation or threat to the safety of Mr. Arafat. The resolution was not, however, formally tabled on Friday. Instead, the Security Council agreed to reconvene next week to hear a briefing on the situation in the Middle East, followed by a public debate in which all UN member states would be allowed to take part.
The Americans have urged Iran to comply with the deadline set by the International Atomic Energy Agency for it to provide evidence that it's not developing a secret nuclear weapons program. Washington said Iran's failure to meet the deadline of the 31st of October would be taken as further proof of what it called clandestine activities. Police in India say they've killed a man they describe as the mastermind behind the bomb attacks last month in the city of Mumbai. Officers said they opened fire on the man, named Nasir, when the car he was in failed to respond to an order to stop. 52 people died in the bombings. Tony Blair is meeting the Irish Prime Minister Bertie Ahern at Chequers later today to discuss the continuing problems in the Northern Ireland peace process. The devolved assembly was suspended last year and fresh elections to it have been postponed twice. It's understood the two governments may be considering a vote within the next 2 months. Reporting from Belfast, here's our correspondent Dennis Murray.
The political process has been stalled since the devolved assembly was suspended almost a year ago. The election, which should have taken place in May, has been postponed, and one thing for Mr. Blair and Mr. Ahern to mull over is whether a poll in October or November would help or hinder. Some local politicians say there are straws in the wind that an election will take place, but that their instinct is that it's more likely to be put off to next spring. The Ulster Unionist leader David Trimble has so far seen off his internal critics, but his position is still not on firm foundations. Sinn Féin and Ian Paisley's Democratic Unionists want an election, as they believe they'll greatly strengthen their positions. There'll be no major announcements after the Prime Ministerial meeting, but Mr. Blair and Mr. Ahern may reach a private determination on how to proceed.
Three people have been arrested in connection with a security alert at Gatwick Airport last night. Roads near the airport were closed and a terminal building was evacuated after an abandoned car was discovered. Army bomb disposal experts carried out three controlled explosions on the vehicle. Nothing suspicious was found. The government is to launch its own monthly index of house prices from next week. Ministers say the aim is to give a more comprehensive guide than the measures already provided by many mortgage lenders. Here's our business correspondent, Hugh Pym.
Economic policymakers keep a close watch on house prices. The Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee takes them into account as it decides what to do about interest rates. But until now, there have been no monthly government figures on house prices. Unlike the versions from lenders like the Halifax and the Nationwide, the government's new index will cover prices of completed property transactions rather than those agreed when mortgages are advanced. As such, it should be a more precise guide to what's going on. But it'll still only monitor about a quarter of the mortgage-funded deals each month and will not include properties bought for cash. There'll be no high-profile unveiling of the government's new house price figures. Bizarrely, they'll be published at midnight on Sunday on the Office of the Deputy Prime Minister's website.
The record label Apple Corp has begun legal action against Apple Computers in a dispute over the use of their name. The record company says the American computer company has broken an agreement between them by marketing software to download music from the internet, as Jane Bennett-Powell reports.
The two big Apple businesses struck a deal in 1991, and it's this agreement which Apple, the London-based record label, claims has been broken by Apple Computers using its logo and name to promote music products. Apple Computers recently launched iTunes in the United States, which allows computer users to download music files legally via the internet. It has negotiated the rights to about 200,000 songs. The record industry likes iTunes, unlike other software systems which download any music for free. But iTunes hasn't been welcomed by Apple Corp, and the two will have to resolve their differences in court. A spokeswoman for the computer giant in San Francisco said the two had differing interpretations of their 12-year-old agreement.
At least 20 people are reported to have been killed in South Korea when a typhoon hit the southeast of the country. Winds of more than 130 miles an hour were recorded, and almost 18 inches of rain caused severe flooding. People were buried in landslides, and thousands were forced to leave their homes to seek shelter in schools and public buildings.
9 minutes past seven. Not much time left at the World Trade Talks in Cancun. Progress so far? Well, about nil, really. Our correspondent there is Mike Wooldridge. Is that fair, Mike?
Yes, I think it is, and I think it's quite clear that they'll be talking right up until the wire. That's on Sunday evening, and at the moment it's by no means clear that they will be able to achieve the sort of consensus that they're going to have to if they can work their way towards this comprehensive global trade deal. And the problem is that that trade deal will cover many more issues than the one that they become so hung up on here, the issue of agricultural subsidies, those the money paid out by the United States and European governments to farmers here. So for the past 3 days, they've really been discussing that and other agricultural issues and not much else. And they haven't even yet got around to producing a text that they can negotiate fully on.
And whose fault is that?
Well, each side is blaming the other here, but I think that the most significant factor of this meeting is the emergence of this new grouping of developing countries, G21, though even tonight nobody's quite sure how many countries are in it. That said, and they're the ones that have been pushing hardest for the elimination of European Union and United States subsidies. That said, India, one of the driving forces in that new grouping, was saying this evening that they feel that there's been a partial success here already, in that they've been able to draw attention in the way that they have to what they see as the distortions in the world trade system. And what they would hope now is that they can agree over the next 2 days on a way of taking things forward. So if those are the ones who are pushing that issue most strongly of all, maybe that does hold out some hope of agreement. What the Americans are saying on the other side of the fence is that they would say that they have been making concessions, they've said that they will eliminate subsidies. There's got to be some quid pro quo. Countries that have got their markets that are still hardly liberalized at all have got to do so if there's to be any chance of agreement here, and indeed they're to make progress towards a wider trade deal.
Mike, thanks very much indeed. We'll be talking to the British Minister Margaret Beckett, who's at those talks at 8:10.
It's 11 minutes past seven. There's going to be a meeting today of the five permanent members of the UN Security Council. They'll be talking about possible new resolution on Iraq. Imogen Fuchs is in Geneva, where the meeting's going on. Imogen, the whole idea is to try and draft in some more international support, given how tense the security situation is. And the French have come up with their own proposals.
Yes, that's right. What the United States wants, as we know, their troops have been struggling to impose some sort of stability in Iraq. The US now really feels it needs extra military support and extra funding to carry on in Iraq. But France and, to a certain extent, Russia feel that if that deal is to be done, the United States needs to cede some of its control in Iraq to the United Nations and to, indeed, the Iraqis themselves.
And the French have set quite a tight timetable for that, and they're talking in terms of a month. How has America reacted to that?
Well, I think on his way to Geneva, the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, has said that that proposal is totally unrealistic. Not really a very auspicious start for the talks, which are due to start in a few hours' time. Each side has been setting out their stalls, as it were, what they would like to see in this draft resolution. So far, these proposals are very far apart, and it is hard to see how, in the short time that they're here in Geneva, they will actually be able to reach some sort of consensus.
Are we seeing a new strength to the coalition that came together to oppose the war? I'm thinking France, Germany, and Russia now, in a sense, reasserting themselves.
To a certain extent. I mean, I think, to be fair to perhaps all the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, nobody wants to see continuing what we're seeing going on in Iraq at the moment. And in the long term, everybody would like, I suppose, sovereignty to be returned to the Iraqi people. But the question is how, and above all, when. And France and Germany, okay, it's not on the Security Council, the permanent member of the Security Council, but it has come with France to make some proposals, don't want an agreement which looks as if America says, we're in there, and now we want you to approve a resolution which basically gives us a license to have more troops from other countries, and we'll command them all and retain political control. France and Germany don't want that. They want some give from the Americans on who's in control in Iraq, and a bigger role for the United Nations.
Imogen Fuchs in Geneva, many thanks.
14 minutes past seven. We've grown used to hearing about the British invasion of France, millions of us crossing the Channel to go on holiday or buy homes, but it seems we are not going to Calais any longer. At least most of us aren't any longer. The number of Britons heading there has dropped sharply. Damage to the city quite a lot, apparently. It's thought that many of us are worrying about reports of big groups of asylum seekers walking the streets. Local people blame a visible increase in the number of refugees on the streets on the closure of the Red Cross Refugee Centre at Zongat, which is nearby. Mike Thompson reports from Calais.
A nighttime ferry arrives at Calais. On landing, security at the dock seems tight, and there's little sign of the much talked of asylum seekers. But after a short drive into town, it's a different story.
I'm now standing in the centre of Calais, just beside a large park. Now, inside the park, there are numerous asylum seekers that are sleeping under trees wherever they can. And it does resemble some sort of giant refugee camp.
They sleep in the park.
Sleep in the park?
Yes.
Very, very cool.
Like, because no house.
No passport.
No house, no money, no passports.
France, no good.
This bedraggled, though quite unthreatening group of asylum seekers is one of many that wander the streets here, waiting to catch that all too elusive boat bound for Britain.
3 months, me here, 3 months. Every day, control. Yeah.
Every day you try that, every day you've been caught.
Yes. No chance.
Not far away, a local hotelier, who prefers not to give his name, stares out of his window, which faces the park. He says it's nothing personal, but he'd be more than happy to see these refugees get their longed-for ferry.
My clients are worried seeing the refugees walking in the street in Calais.
His clients are mostly British, and their fear is his loss.
It's certain that they might avoid Calais and go a bit further away from Calais, go more inland.
Most of the vehicles parked outside this wine and beer supermarket bear British number plates. Owner Marlene Weinberg says this makes their owners increasingly vulnerable. Only the other day, some customers came out to load up their boot, only to find an asylum seeker in it.
They were terrified. It was actually women, so you can imagine. They opened the boot, and the guy was there. He had forced the key lock, and he was just lying in there.
We can say from January till beginning of June, as I say, we have lost 20% of frequentation.
So you believe this is almost entirely because people are convinced the city is crawling with refugees?
Yes.
Bernard Vouvelor, chairman of the tourist office in Calais, blames the media for creating an image which he says just isn't true, along with other factors that are, like the strong euro and fallout from France's anti-war stance on Iraq. His view that tourists have little to fear from Calais' asylum seekers is shared by the commander of the port police, Gerard Rosé, who dismisses recent street battles between club-wielding gangs as a mere business dispute.
Some facilitators try to get the market, if we can say. There is a competition between the Iraqis and Sudanese. They fight together because it's a problem of money, I presume.
Which is just what all of this has become for the people of Calais.
Mike Thompson in Calais, and it's 18 minutes past seven. Will new private health centres help NHS hospitals by cutting waiting times for operations, or simply make things worse by poaching surgeons from the health service? Well, we discussed that question yesterday with John Reid, the health secretary, as he announced the government's plans for these new diagnostic and treatment centres, as they're called. Under private management, each year, they'll carry out around 140,000 non-urgent operations, like hip replacement and cataract surgery. Well, Richard Packard, a surgeon from Windsor, called us after the interview to say that he, for one, wasn't convinced. We'll hear why in a moment, but first, here's what the Health Secretary had to say when he was asked whether the new centres would undermine the NHS by taking away staff.
I'm telling you that the new treatment centres cannot poach staff against the wishes of the local National Health Service, and I'm telling you that where it suits the local National Health Service to treat more patients more quickly and is better for their own staff because there's new facilities, they have the freedom to come to an agreement locally. Oh. And in 4 out of the 26 cases I'm mentioning today, they have done that. Now, I understand that the producers will, you know, whether it's the trade, some trade union leaders, or indeed some consultants, will not like what is happening. But for God's sake, let's think about the patient, the consumer, because there are 20,000 patients waiting in Thames Valley for cataract operations. They are now going to receive them much quicker, much faster as a result of the new treatment centre.
John Reid talking to us yesterday. Well, as I explained, Richard Packard, who's a surgeon at the Prince Charles Eye Unit in Windsor, takes issue with that. And John Reid seemed to be anticipating that kind of reaction when he talked about producers, consultants objecting, rather than taking into account the needs of the consumer, the patients, Richard Packard.
Well, I'm certainly intrigued. The thing that got me rather cross was the mention of the figure of 20,000 waiting for cataract surgery in the Thames Valley. If the Secretary of State had actually checked his figures, he would have found that on the government's own website that for the whole of ophthalmology there were just over 6,000 patients waiting, and if you actually go for cataract surgery, which makes up 70% of the waiting list, it's about 4,200. So one has to wonder where these figures came from.
Well, we did check with the Department of Health this morning and they're standing by that figure.
Well, so I took the figure yesterday from their own website. So unless they're using different figures, it seems very strange to me. I've also done a straw poll around the Thames Valley from the various hospitals as to what figures they are quoting, and they're the same as the ones on the website.
OK, well, to take the general principle then, because we may not be able to get to the bottom of this, but the general principle, which is the new centres are going to help the NHS by giving patients more operations, they should be able to cut waiting lists. Isn't that something to be welcomed?
Of course it is, but the issue here is not whether the patients can be treated in the private sector. I have no particular objection to that. As to whether it's actually necessary. In the Thames Valley, which is the area that I know best about, we actually have spare capacity. To give you an example, last year in Windsor, we opened a second theatre that was paid for by DTC funding. But unfortunately, the funding didn't run to making the theatre work efficiently because we've only been funded for 20% of the time. The independent DTC sector will be coming into our theatres to do our patients at twice the cost. And that seems to me completely ridiculous when they could be done in-house by us using our own theatres.
So you're absolutely certain, are you, that you have the capacity? Because I think across the country, a lot of people will know, you know, members of their own family waiting for hip replacement operations and will say that anything which might help somebody who's in pain get an operation quickly must be worthwhile.
That's a different issue, and I accept that, and there are places in the country where this is true. But I'm talking about my own area. My current waiting list is 3 months.
What about...
And that is... Sorry.
I was just going to... What about Dr. Reid's categorical assurance that the new centres wouldn't be poaching staff from the NHS?
There's nothing to stop somebody resigning from the NHS and becoming re-employed. As a surgeon working in a DTC, I would be able to get £250 a case. As a consultant of over 20 years standing on a salary in the NHS, and I do between 500 and 600 cases a year, I earn approximately £100 a case, and that includes also spending time doing outpatient clinics, teaching, administration, and on call.
Okay, well, Richard Packard, surgeon from Windsor, thank you for joining us.
23 minutes past seven. The war against terror takes many forms. Experts believe a crackdown on the sale of stolen historical artefacts will help disrupt the fundraising activities of terrorist groups around the world. Proposals going through Parliament will make it a criminal offence to deal knowingly in tainted cultural objects. Here's our parliamentary correspondent, Sean Curran.
It's not quite as exciting as Indiana Jones and the House of Lords, but proposals to end the black market trade in looted antiquities could be law by Christmas. MPs have already voted to close loopholes which give middlemen who buy or sell on stolen artefacts immunity from prosecution. Now it's up to the House of Lords. The looting of museums in Baghdad was a dramatic example of cultural asset stripping. But a Liberal Democrat, Lord Reedsdale, reminded peers the problem wasn't restricted to war-torn Iraq.
Iraq is one area, but also Afghanistan, South America, Cambodia, but also in this country. The local sites are being regularly pillaged by nighthawks, some of whom have actually used violent methods when they've been approached and attempted to be apprehended, but also local churches. Have been robbed. There has been a recent state of medieval brasses, so often used for brass rubbings, being removed from churches for sale, and also stately homes.
3 years ago, a group of senior archaeologists and officials from leading museums advised ministers that a new criminal offence should be created to crack down on the trade in looted antiquities. The Conservative former Heritage Secretary, Peter Brook, now Lord Brook, is president of the British Antique Dealers Association and president of the British Art Market Federation.
This successful sector of the British economy has a global reputation for expertise. It is acutely aware of the damage that the black market can do to this reputation, and for this reason has gone to great lengths to work closely with our own authorities with the aim of introducing measures to eradicate criminal activity without at the same time damaging the competitiveness of the legitimate market. I cannot coin a phrase for the art market to match the analogous one that every good policeman hates a bent copper, but the same principle applies. A bent dealer deals a poor hand to every good dealer, and a dodgy auctioneer has first to dodge the rest of the trade. Everyone in the trade is potentially besmirched by a single individual's wrongdoing.
The minister, Lord Mackintosh of Haringey, said what had happened in Afghanistan and Iraq had increased the urgency of the bill and promised government support.
The fact that there will be prosecutions, for example, of internet service providers who provide a facility for trade in illegal antiquities will make a difference and will make those who would propose to sell trade in illegal objects, even though they were not formally covered by the bill, think again about it and perhaps ideally drive them out of business.
Well, the bill was given a second reading, but it's not all good news. Many experts fear that if the proposals, which only cover England and Wales, become law, Scotland could replace London as the centre for the black market in antiquities.
Sean Curran reporting. It's 26 minutes past seven,